Whether it's pan pizza, Detroit style, or Chicago deep dish, everyone has a favorite pizza place in their town.
Hi, this is Susanna from Polkdale, and one of my favorite places to get pizza around here is Puntino's, a new pizza restaurant that opened up in town that's good Italian pizza right here in Central Illinois.
Later this hour, we'll be speaking with the Hungry Hound, Steve Dolinsky, about some of his favorite places, and we'd love to hear from you. Also, amidst heat warnings throughout the state, what are homeless shelters doing to keep residents safe? But first, the State Department is denying passports to some people who have Texas birth certificates.
It's really difficult and try to prove that you were born. They don't trust that you're a U.S. citizen.
That's one man who chose to remain anonymous speaking to CNN. Coming up, we'll talk to the ACLU of Illinois about what's going on at the border and how it could affect Illinois residents. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed your Labor Day weekend. Coming up this hour, how has all of our very hot and stormy weather affected our homeless population? The director of Ottawa's Public Action to Deliver Shelter joins us, and we want to hear from you about your favorite pizza. Food critic Steve Dolinsky is joining us. But first, breaking news out of Chicago this morning. In a shock announcement, Mayor Rahm Emanuel just said minutes ago that he's not running for re-election. Mayor Rahm Emanuel had been widely expected to run again. After two terms in office, he'd already raised more than $10 million for his campaign. But at a hastily called press conference at Chicago City Hall a few minutes ago, with his wife holding his hand and holding back tears, Emanuel said, "I've decided not to seek re-election. This has been the job of a lifetime, but is not a job for a lifetime." There are already 12 other people who have said they will run for mayor of Chicago. We'll be following the story as it develops and provide more details on tomorrow's program. Last week, the Washington Post broke the news that the State Department is denying passports to people who have documents to prove they're citizens. But according to the Post, the Trump administration is accusing hundreds of people born along the U.S.-Mexico border of having fraudulent birth certificates. Now, Texas Democrats are calling for an investigation into the legal limbo at the border, which in some cases has left citizens stranded outside the U.S. Others have been sent to immigration detention centers and entered into deportation proceedings. Here to update us on this situation is Ed Yonga from ACLU Illinois. Hi, Ed. Thanks for being with us. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Nyla. It's good to be with you again.
Ed, I wonder if you can explain what the situation is at the U.S.-Mexico border right now. Are there people who've left the country and trying to regain entry, or does this just involve people who are applying to have their passports renewed?
So it involves both. There are people who have left the country and upon reentry are having their passports challenged, taken away from them, and they're being taken into detention and or denied entry into the United States. In addition, you have people who are attempting to renew their passport, which they've had for years and in some instances, for a long, long time. And serve the country in uniform and other kinds of things, and then lo and behold, they're denied access to a new passport when they go through that process. And I should say that the story in the Post, was the first I think that many of us had heard about this broadly. But this policy of denying passports to people, goes back to 2008 and 2007. What's curious is that there was a settlement in 2009 which sought to make this process more fair and more open.
And Ed, that was something the ACLU was a part of, correct?
That's right. That's right. The ACLU and a number of other groups. The ACLU and other groups at that time identified about 60 people passports or denied entry. And that was right at the time, by the way, I should say. The reason it was important in that time was that was right at the time when you actually were going to need a passport to travel back and forth across the border in that area. Prior to that time, you didn't often need a passport in order to do it. And so, you know, that was something that they did. And when they settled in 2009, they said that the government said that no eligible applicant would be denied a passport. They were going to do more training for the people who made these decisions and create a process for challenging a denial. And it doesn't look like some of that settlement is being abided by at this point in time.
Ed, can you explain the background of why people are being denied and what this issue was in the past in 2008? This involves some midwives along the border in the 1990s.
Right. That's one of the critical. One of the critical things. And I think to set this up, Nyla, we have to acknowledge that, you know, for anybody who's ever spent any time there along the border, you know that these communities are really integrated economically, in terms of family, in terms of social life, in terms of other things that oftentimes, you know, people transport back and forth across the border in a fairly facile way, and that the communities don't really see the distinction of the border as I think we might from hundreds of miles away. What happened in the 90s was there were some instances, a fairly small number of instances that were reported in which midwives, and during the 80s and 90s, there were many children who were born at home using midwives as observers, that there were instances in which midwives acknowledged that they accepted cash payments to say that the children that they helped birth were, were in fact born in the United States and not in Mexico. There was one midwife, for example, who said that out of the hundreds and hundreds of births that she had attended over many years, that she literally had done that on two occasions. And so what happened was people whose birth documents or birth certificate was signed or attested to by this midwife just began to be denied access to a passport. That has now spread to other midwives, even ones where there's never been any allegation that they've done this, and even in some instances to OBGYNs who practiced on both sides of the border. So it really comes back to these kind of fundamental documents and the question of whether or not they're legitimate that has led to much of this behavior or these denials. And in many instances, people are being asked to produce documents that, you know, probably none of us could really find in terms of, whether or not, you know, there is, for example, you could produce records for your mother's prenatal care during that time.
I was going to ask you, Ed, what kind of documents, if you're going to say that a birth certificate is not legal or needs to be proven, if a birth certificate is challenged, how do you prove that? Are there hospital records from that time, or
the kinds of records that have been sought in the past, and it's a little bit curious now. Let me get to that in a second. But what in the past, what has been sought are records, for example, about where your parents or your mother specifically was living. Can you produce a lease or any kind of a record that shows that she was renting a property or living in a particular area? Can you produce reports from a doctor or records from a doctor having treated her, which would record where she lived at that particular time? Or, you know, those sorts of documents. And for somebody who's in their late 20s or early 30s, for example, who's now facing this challenge, you know, that is a significant hurdle in terms of, you know, what it is that, you know, what you're able to produce. The other thing that's curious about what's happening now, and I think that makes this all look, so complex, is that, for example, you have people who are being stopped at producing a passport, trying to re-enter the country, being stopped, the passport is seized, and those people are then detained and put into proceeding, immigration proceedings and even deportation proceedings. And so there's a complexity there in terms of, once you're in that kind of circumstance, it's incredibly difficult to get access to any of those kinds of documents and figure out, exactly what you need to present to someone else in order to prove your claim. And so,
Ed,
I think
apart from the complexity of it, can I ask you, apart from the complexity of it, what is the legal basis for that? Well, I wonder what the law says in a situation like this. If someone thinks they're a U.S. citizen, has had the documentation to prove it, if the government says that it's not the case, whose burden is it to prove the citizenship? Is it incumbent upon the person who thinks they're a citizen, or is it incumbent upon the government?
So this is where this answer gets a little bit more, I'm sorry to add to it, it's a little bit more complex. According to the settlement that the ACLU and the other organizations reached with the government in 2009, that burden should really fall on the government. And the presumption should be that if the person has documents that prove they're a citizen, that they are in fact a citizen. And that the government should work from there and create a fair and equitable means for them to appeal if they're denied. That would certainly mean that they're not in detention. What we see now is with the current administration is sort of the ramping up of the use of detention and other kinds of punishments, and people finding themselves in these circumstances where, not only do they then have the burden of proving it, but they're proving it from a circumstance or from a situation of being held or detained or being left out of the country in a way that makes it even more difficult for them to do that.
I'm speaking with Ed Yonka from ACLU Illinois. He's the public policy director. Ed, how is this situation possibly affecting people in Illinois? I wonder, is this affecting people who maybe were born in South Texas in this time period who are now residents of Illinois and maybe trying to travel back?
It could, Nyla. This is really interesting. I think it could affect anybody from Illinois or from anywhere. I think especially someone who was born at the border area, who was born and whose documents were attested to by, one of the OBGYNs who's being challenged, or, certainly one of the midwives, who then seeks a renewal of their passport. We have not heard of that here in Illinois at this point. It's not to say that it's not happening either here in Illinois or other places in the interior section of the country, but it's just, where it seems that the most significant problems are happening now, as they often are right at the border.
Ed, I wonder if you can ask what, or if you could provide what advice then the ACLU is suggesting for people if they were born in this time period along the border, what you're suggesting they do in terms of travel right now?
I think number one is, I think, probably trying to identify and access, some of these types of documents that the government seems to be asking for in these instances up front is something that would be, would be advisable. I think the second thing is to make sure that you have, access to legal counsel if you're going to travel, and that legal counsel knows what your situation is, including that you might be affected in this way. And then the third thing, I think, would be to, just ensure that you've done, even before you leave, everything that you can to make sure that all of your documents are current, that they're up to date, and that you've you've provided all of the information you need to, when, for example, you're making a request for a renewal. The reality of being faced in this situation where your passport is literally seized and you're sort of questioned in this way and then detained is something I think that's just a nightmare scenario that anybody can imagine. And I frankly, you know, that's one of those things. I don't know what someone does once they're in that place. So I think there needs to be a lot of pre-planning before someone takes a trip across the border.
And we just have a minute left, but I just, can I, we just have a minute left. So I wonder if I can just stop and ask you about another issue. After the break, we're going to be speaking with a shelter that works with some homeless people. And I wanted to ask you about the ACLU's involvement in a panhandling ordinance. There are laws that prohibit panhandling in 15 cities and towns across Illinois, including Champaign, Urbana, Rockford, Peoria, and Chicago. Why is the ACLU, why do you all see this as a First Amendment issue?
Because there are distinctions in the way in which the speech of someone is treated if they're asking for help for themselves versus the way they're asking for help for some other organization or asking for a donation for something else in the way many of these ordinances treat panhandling. The reality is that panhandling and asking for help is something that shouldn't be criminalized. Aggressive behavior can be criminalized. Illegal behavior can be criminalized, to be sure. But what we don't want to do is to simply criminalize someone simply because they're asking for help. And that's really what the nature of the letters that we sent last week along with the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless is looking to change these laws wherever they exist locally, just to make sure that they're consistent with the Constitution.
Thank you for that. That's Ed Yonka with ACLU Illinois. He's the public policy director, giving us a little bit of information about this passport situation the Washington Post first reported, and also about our homeless population. As I mentioned, we'll be talking about that coming up after the break. Checking in on this hot and stormy weather so late in the year, how is this hot weather affecting shelters? Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Support for The 21st comes from the University of Illinois Press, publishers of An Illini Place, Building the University of Illinois Campus, documenting the grand plans and intimate stories behind the creation of a classic American campus. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years of publishing.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Labor Day weekend traditionally marks the end of summer, or at least fewer hot and humid days. And for people seeking shelter and struggling with homelessness, it also means hopefully they won't have to worry as much about finding a cooler place to be. When the hot weather does happen, homeless shelters often serve as cooling centers. And with us now is Carol Alcorn. She's executive director of Ottawa PADS. It stands for Public Action to Deliver Shelters and Shelter in the Illinois Valley, about an hour northwest of Peoria. Hi, Carol. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning. Carol, I wanted to just ask you about at what temperature do you all open up homeless shelters as a cooling center? At what point do you all decide to do that?
Well, I'm thinking it would probably be about 80 degrees, 78, somewhere there. It gets pretty hot. And as it approaches the 90s, it becomes even more critical that we do that.
And we've seen temperatures into the 90s, and so much so that now we get notices around this time of year of certain schools across the state of Illinois that are closing because they don't have air conditioning. How does the hot weather so late into the summer and early fall affect your operations?
Well, there's such a thing as called heat exhaustion, of which is a serious condition, and we have had several individuals who have experienced that when they've come in after being out all day. So it becomes an issue of health that we need to provide hydration during the day and a place to keep cool.
And when you're operating as a cooling shelter, I wonder what additional needs you have. It sounds like you need to have more liquids on hand to provide hydration for people. You're also open during the day, which is something a little bit unusual for your operations, correct?
It is. We typically aren't open during the day. They're out looking for employment or meeting their resource needs out in the community or be able to sit in the library and read for a while. So there's lunches. There's we need extra eyes to be there, volunteers to help us manage the floor and to play games with them and keep them occupied and meet their needs during the day.
And how much more does this cost you all?
Well, it doesn't cost. We're cooling the facility, not to the level that it would be when it's occupied, but we do have to keep it somewhat cool, so it'd be cool in the evening. So there's not, you know, utilities-wise, there's not a cost, but there is a cost for staffing to be in the shelter when we normally wouldn't have that level of staffing.
I'm speaking with Carol Alcorn, who's the executive director of Ottawa PADS. Carol, how do you think this summer went? Do you see a greater need over the summer for needs for your services from people who are homeless than previous years?
You know, we have seen an uptick in those who have needs, and we meet them with local resources. I think part of it is an awareness in the community of what we actually do, and so people are referring them to us to help. But, you know, the economy's better, so people are finding jobs, but there's still an awful lot of homeless individuals and families that are in our communities.
What are the most helpful things for people to donate? I'm sure there are people who are listening now who would like to help. What would you like to say to them?
Their time to volunteer would be fabulous. If you have a couple hours a month and would like to help staff in the shelters, any shelter near you, please apply and give of your time. There's financial needs that we need to keep the doors open and to provide the utilities and the air and the heat. It's not only air in the summer, it's also when it's really cold, we will stay open all day and provide a warming center. You need things like coffee, things to drink, powdered drinks, garbage sacks, toilet cleaner. You know, there's a list on our website, www.ivpads.com. Things that you need in your home to make your home work is what we need in the shelter. Cleaning products, kitchen items, food, all those kind of things that we would need to provide care for people.
That's Carol Alcorn. She's executive director of Ottawa PADS, Public Action to Deliver Shelter. Carol, thanks for being with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your call.
This is the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There are a few topics that you know are guaranteed to set off a calm conversation around dinner table. Then there's other things like religion, politics, and pizza. Tell a group of lifelong Chicagoans that you hate pan pizza and only like New York slices. You better strap in, right? Or try to convince someone from another coast that the best thin crust can be found in taverns in the Midwest. There's Detroit style. There's St. Louis Preval. Of course, there's Hawaiian. Everyone has their favorite pizza. And everyone is right. And it's this kind of passion that has infused Steve DeLincey's new book. It's called Pizza City USA, 101 Reasons Why Chicago is America's Best Pizza Town. He's got subsequent tasting tours. You may know him as the Hungry Hound food reporter for ABC 7 Chicago. He's got a podcast called The Feed with Rick Bayless. And he's with me now at our studios at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in Evanston. Hey, Steve, welcome to the 21st.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we have been talking to folks. By the way, if you would like to join our conversation, it's our phone number, as always, is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. 222-9455. We've been talking to people on social media about pizza all weekend. You've been joining in the Twitter conversation.
Yeah. Nobody has any opinion about pizza, by the way, in Chicago. It's unbelievable. This is why I did this book, because everybody's so crazy about pizza. You know, I started on this path. I was going to just like, I'll dip my toe in the water, see where this goes. Let's kind of jump into a bunch of places and kind of review and rate and just see what kind of a listing I get. And then it exploded like on social media, and I got all this traffic on my website, and I thought, well, there's got to be a book here.
We have people listening all over the state, and we want to hear from you where you get your favorite pizza and what your favorite style of pizza is. So give us a call or tweet us. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. We've got your Facebook comments. We're going to get to those and some voicemails in a minute.
Hey, in my defense, I don't know Bloomington normal pizza scene, so just don't come after me for Bloomington
normal.
I'm not
going to come after you,
all
but
right,
I think
people from there are going to call. Hey, what
they're
about?
Call. Yeah, they're going to. We have some suggestions from all over the state.
Okay,
we have
good.
People who have recommended a couple different places, but I want to ask you first just about how contentious this is. So, where does pizza rank in terms of contentious food that Americans argue about?
Oh gosh, I think it's number one. I really do. I mean, you can argue about hot dogs. They're all kind of similar in Chicago. You argue about Italian beef. It's a very local thing.
And arguing about hot dogs is a very Chicago thing.
It is,
right?
Yeah. And I mean, there's no other food item that is so universal, that's so beloved, that's so multi-interpreted and has so many facets. I mean, in all parts of the country, the globe really, actually, as well. I just saw Ugly Delicious, David Chang's show. They're in Japan eating pizza. So I think it is the number one food item, which is, again, why I wanted to jump into this and just sort of get to the bottom of it in Chicago. Nobody had ever tackled this in Chicago. We have the sacred cows, and we go to the places where when we visit our family, our relatives, and that's kind of it. And there isn't really this rigorous debate and sort of looking under the hood and kind of seeing where the pizza comes from and how is it made and what kind of cheese are they using and how's the dough assembled and what kind of ovens do they have and are they using stone decks or metal decks or, I mean, no one ever really did this. And so that, I just felt like, man, this is a really ripe subject to jump into.
All right, we're going to get into all of this, but first I have to ask you, how much pizza did you eat when you were writing this book?
I ate, well, first of all, spent my advance in about a month and a half on pizza.
On
pizza, yeah. I went to 185 places to get to 101 that I'd recommend. And I initially had done 76 places. Before I agreed to the book, I went to 76 for my website. Only about 48 of those were keepers. And when I pitched the book, the publisher was like, you know, you need to get to 100 or 101. So in order to get to that recommended level, I need another 52 that I'd recommend. I had to go to another 100 because every time you do it, like I call them 3-a-days. I was doing 3 to 4 places a day. One of those places would be great. 2 would be kind of meh. So I needed to hit 185 to get to 101.
Okay.
Which is
what
insane.
So we're talking to Steve Dolinsky about pizza. What gets rejected from the list?
Inferior dough is usually the culprit. A lot of times it's too much of.
I feel like a lot of times it's too much dough.
Well, yeah, or too much dough. One of the terms I have in the book is OBR, optimal bite ratio. And so one of the things that knocks you out of the list is like just no OBR. Because when you think about it, when you like pizza, what do you like about it? You like to have equal amounts.
It has to be a good ratio.
A good ratio, right? Mm-hmm. You get dough, cheese, sauce, topping all together. And sometimes when I go to a place like Pequod's in Lincoln Park, now I've heard Louisa Chu has told me Pequod's in Morton Grove's amazing, but the one in Lincoln Park I always feel has a little bit too much dough at the bottom. I love the crispy, crunchy top and the caramelized tomatoes. Your producer's giving me thumbs up, Robin. Thank you. I really feel like it's too much dough, and that's a problem with a lot of stuffed pizzas in Chicago. I think Giordano's fails miserably on OBR. There's a lot of, and I name these places in the book that I call the overrateds. I just feel like you need to have OBR for a good pizza, and so when you ask what knocks them out, I think, you know, too much dough, too much cheese. A lot of places think more cheese equals better.
Is there such a thing as too much cheese?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely.
There is?
Yeah, well, it's just like anything. In a sandwich, you don't want to have too much protein, you know, versus your you don't have too much mayo. It overwhelms the sandwich. You don't want to have too much of one thing. I think the cheese can be fantastic, but it's got to be in balance and in proportion to the ingredients and the dough and the sauce.
We're speaking with Steve Dolinsky. He's the host of Pizza City Tours. We've been talking to you, as I said, all weekend about this. On Facebook, we had a comment. Tanya said, Lou's Logrado. That's in Peru, Illinois. She said that was the best all time. We also got a call. Here's one of our voicemails.
Hi, this is Susanna from Hopedale. And one of my favorite places to get pizza around here is Spuntino's, a new pizza restaurant that opened up in town that's good Italian pizza. right here in Central Illinois.
What are your favorite places? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455.
I'd be curious what, to see what kind of style they're talking
about. That's what
about,
I was too, wondering.
Like in Peru, if it's a tavern style or...
And what is, so what is tavern style?
Okay, so tavern style, by the way, is Chicago-style pizza, I say in this book. Deep dish was created in Chicago in 1943. Stuffed was created in Chicago in 1974. But the pizza that people in Chicago who live and work and breathe Chicago, they eat tavern-style pizza. It is square cut. It is thin and crispy. The sauce and the cheese are pushed all the way to the edge. There's no exposed heel. A lot of times they'll have a dimpled pan that raises the pizza up a little bit so you have airflow underneath. Places like Pat's do this and Home Run Inn do this. It's really important. I think it's, well, people would say tavern pie, square cut, party cut. If you're from Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, you recognize this pie. This is Chicago-style pizza.
The one in Peru, our very helpful producers are telling me, is deep pan. It's in a cast iron, but the sauce isn't on top, like a deep dish.
Oh, interesting. Kind of like Luisa's in Crestwood. But yeah, that sounds good. I mean, I like deep. I'm not disparaging deep. I think there is good deep out there. La Briola, I'm a fan of. My Pie, I'm a fan of. Luisa's in Crestwood, I'm a fan of. But usually the places fail for having too much of one thing.
And so do you think that it's inaccurate to say that deep dish or that Chicago style is the... that, you know, that double crust or the kind of pie with the sauce on top?
Well, that is a Chicago, it was created in Chicago, right? So in the book, I'm kind of saying deep dish is to Chicago what Times Square is to New York. Now, you wouldn't say that Times Square is the ultimate New York experience, right? It isn't a New York experience. It's created there, but it's not the only thing in that city. And I think that, and mostly it's tourists and visitors. And I feel like the same way about deep dish. I mean, there is a... there's a love for deep because it's created here. It is unique, and people come to Chicago just to try our style, this style of pizza. But I really feel that tavern style is the Chicago style because that's what people who live in Chicago eat every week.
So tavern style is the Chicago style. We're talking to you about your favorite pizza, whether it's Detroit style. We heard from people on Facebook, Aurelio's, the thin pizza at Aurelio's.
Yeah,
was...
from the old oven, right? I know Ben Bradley is a colleague of mine who's at WGN now.
And remind me, where's Aurelio's?
Where is it?
Mm-hmm.
Homewood and Flossmoor, but it's in Homewood technically.
So south.
South.
Yeah,
yeah, south suburbs
of the city.
And
mm-hmm.
So people from there, and this is another term in the book I have, it's Pigue syndrome, P-I-G-U-E, pizza I grew up eating syndrome. And Ben Bradley is a friend of mine. We used to work at CLTV together, worked at Channel 7 together. He's now WGN. He's a proud Homewood boy, and he swears by Aurelio's, and I tend to argue it's not the best pizza in the world. It's fine.
It's pizza you grew up
It's pizza you grew up eating, absolutely. And the old oven only implies you need to have it from the stone deck, and the stone decks are very important because it has good heat transfer, and you get the bottom crust crispy. If you put it on the conveyor belt oven, it's not going to work, but they say old oven specification, that's stone deck.
1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Oh, we've got a caller from Bloomington. Let's go to
All
Kurt
right.
from Rochelle.
All right, give it to me.
Hi, Kurt. Where's
Hello.
Your favorite
Hello.
Pizza?
I'm actually calling from Rochelle, Illinois, but I'm a Bloomington Normal native.
Ah, okay. And where's your favorite pizza, Kurt?
Well, Luca Grill, downtown Bloomington.
And what style is that?
It's a thin crust. They cook that dough right on aluminum foil that's against the stone in the oven. You get a thin crust, and you're talking about that balance. You get that a la Baldini. They put a little bit of everything on there, but it's a perfect balance of thin, crisp dough.
And they
then all your favorite toppings.
They cut it square?
They do. They cut it square, yes. Uh-huh. I used to work there, so I had plenty of it.
And then if you get sausage, it's the bulk sausage with lots of fennel and oregano that you pinch and press?
Oh, yeah. I think they're making that sausage right there in the kitchen.
Yeah, that's another very Chicago thing is having that pinch and press.
Thanks, Kurt.
Thanks, Kurt. That pinch and press bulk sausage. When I was on the East Coast eating a bunch of pizza for research, I noticed that it's usually sliced from a link, like they look like coins.
Oh, that's a very New York thing,
and
right?
They're milder and a little sweeter. And the sausage game in Chicago, I think, is just so much stronger.
We are going to get to your calls after the break, 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet as well. Our handle is 21STShow. We'll continue our Pizza Across Illinois conversation with Steve Dolinsky, who's the host of Pizza City Tours in Chicago, after the break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Steve Dolinsky, and his most recent book is called Pizza City USA, 101 Reasons Why Chicago is America's Best Pizza Town. He does tours of Chicago. We're going to talk about that in a minute, as well as his upcoming pizza tour he's going to be doing in central Illinois. But we're also taking your calls, 1-800-222-9455. Your comments on Facebook, Catherine says, the pizza cellar in Princeton, Illinois, sweet sauce, super salty cheese, floury thin, not too crisp, not too mushy crust. It is tavern style pizza perfection.
And that's what I found on the south side of Chicago, too, is a lot of sugar in the sauce. Place like Arenello's and Palermo's and Triano's, they love sugar in the sauce. That is definitely a south side. I'm guessing maybe downstate. Maybe it goes all the way downstate to do that. And I'm going to a couple places, actually. I'm going to be at Pygmalion September 28th in Champaign. We've got both mayors from Champaign and Urbana at this event. We're going to do the book event. We're going to talk about the book. And then we're going to go on a pizza crawl. And we're going to go to a couple places, I think Monocle's and Papa Del's and Bread Company. And there's a couple places in there we're going to go to. But it's on the 28th of September.
Speaking of Papa Del's, I think we've got a caller from Champaign on the line. Hey, Tony, welcome to the 21st.
Hi. I guess your guests would know, speaking of Champaign and Papa Del's, it has to be mentioned. For years, it's won the Champaign News Gazette Award for the best pizza. I mean, years.
And I got to take issue. I went there about 2 years ago. My daughter goes to U of I, and we were down there visiting another one of her friends, and they all wanted to go to Papa Del's. And I thought, again, we talked about OBR earlier in this show. I thought, way too much dough. Every bite I had was all dough. That to me was not pizza. That was almost like a stuffed pie at Giordano's or the pizza, what's it called, the pizza and oven grinder here in Chicago, where it's like a pound of cheese melted in a bread bowl. It was too much of one thing, and so I felt Papa Del's had too much dough.
Tony, are you there still?
Tens of thousands of people that would disagree with you on that.
Really?
They sell unbelievable amounts of pizza. I mean, they ship them all over the country to former U of I students frozen.
Well, and this is very funny. One of our producers, a former U of I grad, says disagreement over Papa Del's has caused family strife.
Oh, wow.
See, I do think but I think it's to your point also, the pizza that you grew up with, pizza you have in college, maybe you really also really love?
Yeah, I mean, I loved Pizza Pit at University of Wisconsin in Madison. I don't think I would think Pizza Pit would make my top 50 now, but that was at a different age in my life, different point. I think, what he said is true. People probably have it shipped all the time, just like they go to Giordano's because it reminds them of their childhood. I just don't think, for recommending a pizza, I'm going to put it in my top 10.
I feel like Giordano's and Northwestern are inextricably linked in my mind, because I feel like when I was at Northwestern, all we did was eat Giordano's.
And by the way, I should clarify, Giordano's is not deep dish. It is stuffed pizza. Totally different.
Explain
style.
What do you think stuffed pizza
so
is.
So stuffed is that same construction like deep dish. You have the bottom dough, you push it up along the sides, you've got your cheese base layer, and you've got your ingredients. And then you've got a thin layer of dough over that, and then a lake of tomato sauce on top of that. Sprinkle
that
with some pecorino
stuffed.
Romano. That's stuffed. So when you pull it out, you get this beautiful cheese pull for your Instagram feed.
I thought that was deep dish. See, you're teaching me things here,
No.
Steve.
Stuffed pizza. Eduardo's and Nancy's and Giordano's
and
are all stuffed.
And Papa Del's. Tony, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. Is Papa Del's stuffed?
Yes, they have stuffed.
Oh.
They have stuffed. I've had stuffed.
So they have, but I'm always wondering, is that their specialty? So when I did the book.
I don't think it's their specialty, but maybe someone from Champaign should call in, who's lived in Champaign longer than I, who knows more about this, should give us a call and help us with that.
Because I always call these places anonymously, and I say, what are you known for? What's your specialty? And if they said it was stuffed, that's what I'd order for
right,
the book.
Right. So 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Someone can help us out with the Papa Del's question.
By the way, we don't do any stuffed stops on our pizza tours on Pizza City USA. We do four tours every weekend at pizzacityusa.com. Four tours around Chicago. I lead a bus tour every Saturday that goes to four neighborhoods, and we have three walking tours, but we only do three of those four have a deep stop on them, and the rest are like artisan and tavern and Neapolitan and interesting styles.
If you're in DeKalb on Facebook, Sarah Lene told us that if you're looking for gluten-free pizza, Marco's and Pizza Village in DeKalb are good bets. What do you think about the whole gluten-free? Because now I feel like a lot of pizza chains are offering this for people who...
They are. Yeah, and I think it's good for people who are celiac.
Does it make a difference?
It does make a difference. It's not the same kind of gluten action in your dough that you're used to. But I know that Forno Rosso, which is a Neapolitan place in Chicago, offers it. I know Lou's, I think, has a gluten-free option now as well, as they should since they have 52 locations all over the place. But I think it's a great option for people who are celiac and who cannot digest gluten. I think it's really, it's a close approximation, but I wouldn't, if you don't have that limitation, I wouldn't order it. It wouldn't be something I would get.
What are people going to learn on a pizza tour with you?
They're going to learn about the history of the neighborhoods for sure. They're going to learn about the history of the place we're visiting. Usually talk to the owners. We always go into the kitchen. We talk about the ovens. We talk about the dough, what the construction of the pizza is, how important stone decks are, all kind of the behind the scenes of the pizza place we're visiting, but also some history. And I mean, getting to hang with the owners a little bit, like when we go to Pat's, you know, the third generation owner is there with us and she takes us back in the kitchen. We see the mixer and the cooler, and she talks about the 6-day process making the dough. So I kind of like
six
that.
6 days?
6 days to make the thin dough at Pat's.
Why?
Yeah. It has to dry out. They have a very thin setting. They actually had to drill holes in the dough sheeter to make it extra thin, and then they push it between layers of paper in the cooler for 3 days, and they let it proof and rest and dry out in the cooler. So they have a day of resting when they first mix it, and they've got another day when they roll it out and let it rest, and they let it rest for 3 days in the cooler.
The history. I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit about the history of pizza in Chicago and in Illinois.
Sure. Well, in Chicago, I mean, it's certainly started. The first instances were near Taylor Street in the 1920s, even 30s. Vito and Nick's has been around since the 40s. That was one of the oldest. They moved to where they are. That, by the way, that's my best tavern style in the Southwest.
That's
side.
Your best tavern style.
84th and Pulaski, yeah. Vito and Nick's. So since early 40s. But it had always been a thin pizza. When I say tavern style is Chicago style, here's the reason why. Because people in the 30s and 40s were going from the factories home. They'd stop at the tavern, and the bar owners realized, hey, we could get these people to drink more if we give them something salty to eat, kind of like toasted ravioli in St. Louis, you know, something crispy, crunchy, salty. That'll get them to buy more beer. And so you could hold these little tiny squares in your hands very easily. They could pass this around the bar very easily. It's much easier than a big unwieldy New York wedge, which you've got to fold in half and kind of balance on two paper plates.
It was food that helped make drinking easier.
Absolutely. It was a drinking lubricant. Yes. And that's where our history of pizza in Chicago comes from. Mark Molnati told me that, you know, they wanted to get this pan specced out to make a deep dish, his grandfather. And that there was no pan in existence. And he goes, you know, we didn't, the pizza was free at the time. Like, people would just expect to have a little free pizza in the bar as kind of like a little sampler, amuse bouche, if you will, a little like freebie.
A little tavern amuse bouche.
A little tavern amuse bouche.
After you get off of your factory work. Okay.
Right. So it was a freebie. And so people at first, when they started deep dish, like it wasn't even popular. It took like 12 years before they opened up the second one, which was Due. So 43 was really when that sort of tide turned. They started doing the deep dish. Didn't catch on. A dozen years later, they opened up Due down the street. And then you started seeing places like in the 60s and 70s, Gino's East. Giordano's didn't open until 74. And as I said, that's stuffed. So different style. But 43 and 74 were the two important dates or years, because that was deep and then stuffed.
Let's get to a couple callers before I get back to you, Steve, because you mentioned St. Louis. I want to ask you about Prevail. But let's start with Gary in Rockford. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello.
Where's your favorite pizza?
I was driving along and listening to your show, and I wanted to mention Red's in Harvard, Illinois. Calling from Rockford, and we drive over to Red's. And their pizza is, like he's describing, very thin and excellent. Crispy and, on the bottom.
Yep, and the sauce and the cheese pushed all the way to the edge, right? There's no exposed heel on the perimeter.
Exactly.
Yep. That's such a Midwestern thing, that tavern style
pie.
Thanks,
Gary.
That's really.
Thank you.
And I've been to Harvard, and I got to check out Red's next time I'm up there, because it's kind of on the way to Lake Geneva, I think.
Let's go to Jennifer in Champaign. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi there, Nyla.
Hi. Are you here to answer our Papadel's question, or do you have something else to add to?
No, I wanted to put in my vote for Pizzeria Antica in Champaign.
Ah, okay. That's downtown, right?
Stellar pizza there.
Are you saying we should hit that on our pizza crawl on the 28th?
Yes, absolutely.
What do you like about it, Jennifer?
They make just a really good, it's a Neapolitan style pizza, so it's not the kind of typical tavern style. So that's really nice. And they use really good quality ingredients, and you can really taste them come out in the pizza.
That sounds great. Yeah, I have not seen many Neapolitans in Champaign since I've been visiting my daughter down there.
That's Pizza Antica is, I think, relatively new to downtown Champaign. I say relatively. I think it's been there for a couple of years. Can I ask you about, speaking of Neapolitan, the fast casual semi-Neapolitan Blaze, which is a
semi-Neapolitan.
Yeah. It's a chain, but it's sort of popping up all across Illinois. Yeah. What do you think about
it's not
chains versus... Go ahead.
All right, let's just be clear. It's not Neapolitan, first of all. And she was just pointing out that the Neapolitan, they do use great ingredients. You use 00 flour. You have to use fior di latte, fresh mozzarella. You have to use San Marzano tomatoes. It's got to be in a wood-burning oven, et cetera, et cetera. So Blaze is kind of the McDonald's, if you will, of Neapolitan pizza. It's very fast. They do have it's a gas-fired oven. It's kind of like a Chipotle. You pick out what you want, you assemble, you know, and that's where you run into trouble. You can overdo it. And most people are like, oh, I want that
and then
pineapple
it gets really
and pistachios.
Soggy
it's
and
too
it's
heavy.
Over,
and
right.
Because it's a
because
thin crust.
Because we don't know the ratio.
You don't know the ratio. And they don't tell you at those stores. So they're like, oh, pile it on. Put on more vegetables. And it looks pretty. And then you put it in the oven. It comes out. And it's like, oh, that bottom crust is so soggy and overwhelmed from the moisture that's coming out of the ingredients. It's just... I am not a fan of, like, I've never been a fan of the flat top grills where you do it yourself or the, it's just, you know, you go to a restaurant
leave
to have
pizza
the experts
making
do
to
it.
The professionals.
Yeah,
is
I
what
think
you're
so.
Saying.
I think so.
Speaking of which, what do you Italians make of Chicago and Midwestern pizza?
What do Italians from Italy think of us?
Yes.
Well, I've got a friend from from Rome, actually, funny enough. I've taken her for Italian beef sandwiches, which she loved. They don't quite know what to make of the deep dish. They really think it's kind of odd. I did have some journalists here, though, from the Middle East recently, and they just love the deep dish at La Briola because his OBR is working, I think. You haven't been there, have you?
No.
You got to go.
I'm just laughing at your OBR.
Oh, it's
all
so,
right, we'll have to go to La Briola. So we didn't talk about Detroit style.
Oh, that's also coming on the scene. There's like five or six now in Chicago. It's kind of like, well, Jets is the
Jets
fast
and
food
Jets
version.
Is the
right.
fast, but Jets is the fast food version.
Right.
Okay.
But it's a kind of a soft, almost like focaccia, and there's brick cheese on top, which is from Wisconsin, pushed all the way to the edge of the square pan. So it kind of caramelizes around the perimeter like Pequod's. Mm. And you've got this soft middle but crispy bottom, and they usually serve it on a rack so that there's airflow underneath so it's crispy as well. They only put the sauce on top in like two racing stripes after it comes out of the oven. So it's really technically like cheese bread with pepperoni or whatever and then sauce on top.
Speaking of cheese, we didn't talk about St. Louis Provel.
Provel, which is technically not cheese, but it is a combination of mozzarella, Swiss,
provolone.
Is it like
provolone. American cheese food?
It is a processed item, yes. It's a cheese item. What do they call it? It's not, technically, the USDA can't say it's cheese. So it's this blend. People from St. Louis swear by it. My college girlfriend is from Ladue, so and I had been there, and I've been to the original Emo's a couple months ago for research. I'm not a fan. It's okay when it's baked with other ingredients. I don't like the crust, though. Emo's is so big now. It's such a corporation that the dough is just churned out by machine, and it has zero texture, zero flavor, zero character. But there is a place in New York I found. The guy's from St. Louis. He's doing neo-Neapolitan pizza with Provel, and it's amazing.
We're almost out of time. Let's go to one last caller. Hey, Ben from Champaign. Welcome to the 21st. You grew up in Moline?
Yes, I grew up in Moline.
Where's your favorite pizza there?
Well, first, can I say my favorite pizza in Champagne is Manzala's Pizza. It's kind of an old world Sicilian type pizza.
Gonzalez.
But I like in Moline, I like Frank's Pizza in Silvis, Illinois, and it's a little bit different. It's kind of a malty crust. I don't know what is that stuff they put on. Yep. That's on the bottom of the
cornmeal.
Pizza cornmeal, right?
Yep. The malty crust. Yes, there is a place in Chicago called Roots. It's the only Quad City style pizza. I lived in the Quad Cities for a year, actually. I lived in Davenport. And I know that style of pizza. That's a big thing. They're the malty, sort of bready. It's great with beer, I think, when you have
Ben,
that pizza.
Ben, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Remind us, say again, what the favorite place is in Champaign?
My favorite place in Champaign is Manzala's Pizza.
Manzala's,
yes. It's by downtown on 1st Street.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right. We added another one to the list there. Thanks, Ben. Thanks for that.
Thanks.
So just one last question. We're almost out of time. Why is Chicago the pizza capital?
Because we have 10 different styles of pizza. That's really, I think the diversity makes us unique. There's thin, tavern style, Neapolitan, artisan, New York style slices, deep, stuffed, Sicilian, Roman, and Detroit.
right.
Ten.
If we haven't made you hungry for pizza, you have not been paying attention. I want to thank Steve Dolinsky for being with us. You can check out his Pizza City USA tours. As he said, he's going to be in Champaign in a couple of weeks. Thanks for being with me, Steve.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for tuning in today. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.